Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, we've got Brady Henderson of ESPN on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline, or as I like to call him, the captain of the seas of Lake Union. Brady, how are you?
I'm honored that you would think of me at that. I'm really not much of a captain. I just live on a boat. You don't want to know how bad my captain skills are, but I appreciate the gesture.
Close enough, Brady. That's close enough.
Yeah.
It's good to have you on with us. How was it this weekend being able to get some football going out on the VMAC, and how different was it compared to all the other rookie mini camps that you have covered in the past?
Quite a bit different, for a number of reasons. A, there was a lot fewer people there, just because, you know, only having three draft picks, it's the draft picks plus the undrafted guys, second, third year guys who are still eligible. And then normally, you know, in a normal year, there's dozens of tryout guys that a team will bring in just to fill out. You have enough players there for that rookie minicamp to fill out like a two deep roster. And this year, teams were only allowed five. I don't believe the Seahawks had any tryout guys there. So there was 31 players. There's usually about 50 guys there. So just a lot less players there. It was only over 2 days as opposed to three. And the tempo was slower, and it didn't seem like there was as much teamwork there. So for somebody like me watching it, I would say there was less really conclusions to be drawn from there. Not that you can make any definitive statements by watching, rookies there in May, no pads, no veterans or anything like that. But I think even less so, it's hard to really glean a whole lot. And I think for the Seahawks, they're using that more as, indoctrinating those guys into their system, into the way they practice. And so I don't think even the evaluators there are going to learn a whole lot about these guys over a setting like that, and especially somebody like me. But there were, I think, like the Daryl Taylor thing was the big takeaway for me, and just how realistic it seems that he could be their strong side linebacker.
Brady, going on that Daryl Taylor comment there, what exactly did Pete Carroll say about him, and what were your overall impressions about that? You talk about him potentially being the Sam linebacker, so obviously that has an impact on what KJ Wright's going to be, right? Or where he's going to be.
I think so. Yeah. It makes it harder for me to envision Wright being back. And look, it's not totally like an experiment with Taylor, because I think they have some background on him from college playing a similar role. So it's not like, sometimes you see teams just, it's a total experiment where they will just try a guy out at a position just for a few days just to see what he looks like there. I think there's a lot more to this than that. And Pete Carroll said that's his role for now, is that he is, they're looking at him in that Bruce Irvin type role where, strong side linebacker on early downs, and then he puts his hand in the dirt and rushes the passer in passing situations, and it makes perfect sense to me. Just because look at how many edge guys they have, that's the perfect way to get a guy like Taylor on the field, and it really reminds me of the circumstances that led Bruce Irvin into that role in 2013. Remember, Irvin was a rookie in 2012. The next offseason, they signed Michael Bennett, they signed Cliff Avril. So they had a lot of edge guys, and that was a way to get an athletic playmaker on the field. I think it's a pretty similar circumstances now where, what's the one thing that really stood out about the offseason moves that they made is that they're loaded on the edge. And so that's a way to get, a former second round pick like Taylor on the field. He did some dropping in Tennessee, so it's not a completely foreign role to him. He didn't play last year. He's coming off an injury. It sounds like the injury is, according to Pete Carroll, they believe that the injury is behind him, but he's still effectively a rookie who's coming off an injury. So it's not like you can really make any, guarantees about how much he's going to play, let alone how well he's going to play. But it is a pretty intriguing option. And I think, like you said, with KJ Wright, it just makes it harder to imagine KJ Wright being back unless there's some sort of an injury situation. I think it's pretty clear from what Pete Carroll said, they really want a pass rushing presence in that role, a la Bruce Irvin. and a la Daryl Taylor. And so maybe there's an injury and maybe KJ Wright comes back that way. But at this point, I kind of think that that's what it might take.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective there, Brady, in terms of the comp between potentially Daryl Taylor and Bruce Irvin and where the roster was, how it was constructed and what the needs were, finding a way to get a talented player on the field. Everybody wants to know, second round pick, Dwayne Eskridge, where is he at? How did he look, you know, just from your eyes and what Pete Carroll had said?
Yeah, Jake, I wish I had like a ton of takeaways on Dwayne Eskridge that I could give you, but unfortunately, you know, a lot of the way it was set up is that us reporters were on the berm watching, and for the majority of the time, the offensive guys were on that far field. And so I was looking through my binoculars, trying to watch as much Dwayne Eskridge as I could. And it was hard to tell. I mean, I would say that it was everything that I thought and what most people would assume, that you've got a very quick, very fast guy. I saw him get behind the defense, at least a couple times, caught at least one deep ball from Danny Etling, which was on the near field, which I had a pretty good view of. You know, the thing that stands out to me just when I look at him, you know, you hear about a speed guy and a, you know, 5'9", 5'10", whatever he is, and you just kind of tendency to think like scrawny. He's pretty well built. You know, he's 190 pounds, and you can tell he is pretty solid. So what that means in terms of how good he's going to be or what role he's going to play, it's meaningless, but that's just an observation. Is that, and Pete Carroll says that too every time he talks about him physically, is that he's a well-built guy. And so he's not, this isn't like you know, DeSean Jackson or tight, you know, or somebody smaller like that. No knock on those guys, but he's a well-built guy.
Hey Brady, did you guys talk to Pete Carroll at all or John Schneider at all about the fact that they didn't try and get more draft picks this year?
Rod, how's it going? I was not aware that you were on this call. Pleasant surprise.
It's good to talk to you, man.
It's good to talk with you too, Groz. It's been a while. In terms of trying to get more draft picks, you know, they, I believe when they took Trey Brown in the fourth round, I think John Schneider made a comment afterwards that they had thought about trading back again. Remember, they traded back initially from, I think, 129 to 137. And then he said that they thought about trading back again, but that was in the context of what he was saying was they were trying to get more draft picks to move up earlier to take Stone Forsythe. And so it really doesn't seem like they went into this draft with an idea that they really wanted to, you know, double their pick total of three, which I think a lot of people assume that was the case because everybody knows the history and everybody knows that they had, you know, the fewest draft picks in the NFL. I really think, and I said this before, this is not a good draft, not as deep of a draft as it normally is, because you had so many, you know, would-be prospects go back to school, less information on all these guys because the pre-draft process was not the same with no formal combine, no in-person visits. And so it really seems to me like they were more selective and they weren't, it really just seems like they didn't go into this draft thinking that they absolutely had to come away with six or seven picks, more so that they were going to identify guys that they wanted and they were going to go get them.
Brady, what are some of the undrafted guys, their stories that really stand out to you or any performances that Pete Carroll highlighted from any of these undrafted players?
Kay Johnson is the one that comes to mind. He's from Lake Taps, Washington, down south, went to Sumner High School and then Stanford. And he, from what I understand, he had several offers that were better than what the Seahawks gave him. They gave him a $20,000 signing bonus, which is actually – that's one of the bigger signing bonuses for an undrafted free agent that I can recall them giving out in a while. They also gave $20,000 to Brian Mills, an undrafted rookie cornerback this year. But it's rare for them to go that high, or it's not common, I should say. And so that gives you an idea of what his market was like as an undrafted guy and how bad they wanted him. And again, from what I understand, he had better offers in terms of bigger signing bonuses. Some other teams were offering him, you know, guaranteed salary. And he turned it down to play for his hometown team. And, it's just a cool story. I mean, he's kind of a, you know, a smaller kind of slot guy who was a former running back. So you can kind of tell he's another well-built guy. He's got some return ability. And so, I think, you know, the bottom end of that receiver rotation, I think that's a possibility for him. Because beyond Tyler Lockett, beyond DK Metcalf, and obviously Dwayne Eskridge, I think there's some spots to be won there. And so it's, and I imagine that's why another reason why he considered Seattle an appealing place, just because he probably saw it the same way, that you could maybe win a roster spot here.
I know the access was limited, but is it beginning to feel a little more like normal covering the team, Brady?
A little bit, yeah. You know, for the second half of last season, we were not really allowed to be in the building. So I think any time, you know, at first it was, we were coming in there every day in the morning and getting tested just to be able to go and sit in the media room. And then we would still do everything virtually in terms of, you know, Zoom press conferences and whatnot. And so, yeah, I think a little bit, you know, we were out on the hill, not everybody was wearing a mask, and obviously we were, you know, spaced out and pretty far away from the players, but, I guess we'll see once the season starts. I think the big thing is going to be access to players and open locker room and what that's going to look like. Imagine that, you know, even a few months from now, there's no guarantee that that's going to be the case, but hopefully it is, just because that's, you know, more access for us is always a better thing.
You're hearing Brady Henderson of ESPN on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Brady, one of the other interesting things that got brought up along the way, and talk about, you know, Graz asking you the question about getting back to normal, is the idea of this standoff between the players and the NFL. The Seahawks are, you know, the players already, you know, made a written statement that they are not going to participate in voluntary workouts. Pete Carroll sounded like he's still trying to encourage guys to get out there to the VMAC and seeing if there's any possible way that they can do it. Even saying that they're going to change the way that they're going to format their respective off-season program to try and potentially entice some of these guys to come back and take less of a workload that normally would have been. So what do you make of that current situation right now?
Yeah, you know, you can tell when Pete Carroll was talking about that he was disappointed in that. And the point that he seemed to be making was that, you know, players made that decision based on information that was available to them at the time, which, remember, this was over a month ago, I believe. And so this was before, you know, the CDC came out and relaxed the guidelines on masks and everything like that. And obviously, there were a lot fewer vaccinated people at that time. And so I think the subtext of what Carroll was saying is that he wishes that they would have made the decision, or he wishes that, you know, they could have made the decision based on what everybody knows now. And it does sound, you know, Carroll was asked by another reporter if there's any thought to, you know, apparently some other teams are negotiating with players about possibly, you know, if the team, you know, nixes the mandatory minicamp, that if the players were to show up for a certain number of OTAs, that would be a trade-off. And so it sounds like, you know, he said that they've considered a lot of things. I don't know if he specifically said that that's maybe in play, but it does sound like they're working on trying to get some of those guys in. And, you know, the one thing I was able to clarify is that the players said that they are not taking part in in-person voluntary work. And so they're still doing, you know, the virtual meetings via Zoom. And so it's not like these guys are just completely absent and out on their own. They're still doing the virtual team meetings. They're just not doing the in-person voluntary stuff like OTAs and, you know, on-field drills like that.
So, Brady, do you anticipate, because Pete Carroll did mention that they are going to change their format. They're going to go from phase two to phase three. And for the average person, that doesn't really mean much to you, but it just means in the different mode of which they practice or what they can do out on the field. Do you anticipate that people like yourself and media are going to be able to get back out there here in the next week or two to evaluate and watch more practice?
Yeah, that's something I'm still trying to figure out, because normally, you know, they have 10 OTA practices, and in a normal year, I think we get to go watch 3, 4, 5 of them, maybe. I can't remember what the exact total is. And so I would like to, even though it's probably, at this rate, it seems like it's just going to be rookies again for the most part. So it's going to kind of be an extension of what we saw over the weekend. But, I'm curious to see what that looks like, because you know, it's just another opportunity to watch the team. And again, there's not always definitive takeaways from practices like this, but it is, the more information, the better.
All right, Brady. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you coming on. That was Brady Henderson of ESPN on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. We'll talk to you soon, Brady. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, buddy.
Good talking with you guys. See you, Graz.
All right. Don't forget, you can stream your favorite 710 ESPN Seattle shows at home through your smart speaker. And if you don't have one, head to 710sports.com/win now, where you can enter to win one. It's one day for the month of May. And this month, we're giving you 31 chances. Graz, 31, because there's 31 days in the month of May. Hard to do the math on that one, but that's why 31 chances to win a 710 ESPN Seattle logoed smart speaker. Head to 710sports.com/win to learn how you can get one of those bad boys. DJ, let's go to Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
All right, first down to you, Jake. Pete Carroll met with the media on both Friday and Saturday to talk about rookie minicamp. And he talked about second-round pick Dwayne Eskridge. What did you love to hear Pete Carroll say about the wide receiver?
Well, the one thing that I loved is that Pete Carroll, yes, he did mention his on-the-field presence and his skills, but the other thing that he mentioned I think stands out a little bit more.
Probably more than anything, his attitude. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He's going to prove it that he belongs. That's probably as valuable as anything he could have and bring to this, you know, to our club. He's talented. You know, you can see it already that he's quick and explosive. He caught the ball well. Also got good strong hands. So he's made nothing but good impressions so far. But I'm really fired up about his attitude because he's here to prove something, and that always brings out the best in guys.
Why does that fire me up so much, DJ? Why do I think that stands out more? Is because when you have a player that brings that type of edge, that has that kind of presence on the field where it is palpable, that means that you're a guy that commands greatness around you, and you're also somebody that is striving to be the best version of yourself each and every single day. One of the things that they have to figure out with Dwayne Eskridge is how much can he take on as a rookie. They have big plans for him. I believe that he can be a big-time, immediate impact playmaker for the Seahawks, but it's going to be about Dwayne Eskridge. And just for everybody out there, he goes by D. So D. Eskridge is what you should refer to him now. But D. Eskridge is a guy that I think that if he can take on and have the same level of work ethic and dedication that DK Metcalf brought to the table his rookie season, look out, because this is going to be a lot of fun.
Second down. All right, Graz, I got a second down question for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we're going to take a little bit of a detour here from football, and I'm just going to ask you this, Graz. When you watch Jared Kelnick, he's only playing 4 games for the Mariners. Who does he remind you of?
We talked about this a little bit. He's cocky, so there's a little bit of Bryce Harper in him. No question about that. I think I also see a lot of Lenny Dykstra in him, the old Nails guy with Philadelphia, and then more recently Shane Victorino in his prime, just a kind of an igniter guy. You know, in his case, it's got some power and it's got the cockiness of a Harper. So I would say of all those guys, probably the most you hope, like Harper, who's turned out to be quite a ball player, but we're just getting used to Kelnick. We're going to see him and hear a lot of him. Coming up this rookie year, it'll be easier to figure out who he reminds you of. But those are first impressions, is that he reminds you of those guys in my book.
Really like that Lenny Dykstra comp there, with maybe a little more pop, hopefully. Third down. Jake, Pete Carroll seemed to talk himself in a circle when asked to describe Shane Waldron's offense. Why?
Let's listen to this cut, and let's hear Pete Carroll kind of talk about this offense and why he talked himself in a circle, and why I think it's kind of a beautiful thing.
That's not the right way to describe it. No, it's beautifully thought out. It's got such a complimentary makeup to it. That's why I fell in love with what he was bringing. It really makes sense. It's really smart. Our guys have to really work hard at the discipline to execute it in the right manner. There's a lot of terminology. It won't look as much different as it sounds to us because the system that we're putting in to make sure that we can utilize all of the variations and the complements that are packed in here. It's not a simple offense at all. I wouldn't give Al that much credit either.
So.
Wait a second. If you just saw that in writing, if you just saw that written on a piece of paper,
yes,
you would think this guy is crazy. This is someone without a grip on reality. It's gibberish.
Oh, Graz, I love it. It is. It literally is. It's crazy. what Pete Carroll just did in terms of talking himself through a circle, but I'm going to tell you why. The reason why he first started out talking about, well, it's not all that complex, and then finishing it with, it is complex, is because the offense in and of itself is a, as he described, a beautiful thing from an X's and O's standpoint, where you can have the same formation, the same motion, the same type of setup, and keep it relatively simple that way, and yet be extremely complex in the way that you attack and utilize those things. The one thing that I have been so impressed about this offense, and have been impressed for quite some time, is the ability to take something simple and to be purposeful to make it more complex. The motion, the fly sweep motion, has a purpose to it in terms of how it manipulates and moves the defense in the running game, the play action pass game, the quick game, the screen game. It all has a purpose and a function along with everything else. And what other offensive coordinators or other systems have a hard time with is they'll say, hey, we'll take a formation and we'll have, Groz, let's say 15 plays, but they all don't complement each other. They're completely different. And I think what Sean McVay and this system has been able to do is create something that is complex and a complex system to be able to get to all these different things in a very simplistic way of same formation, same motion, same setup and everything. And it makes it really difficult on defenses and offenses, defensive coordinators, to really get a true beat on what you're going to do next.
Okay.
Fourth down. All right.
It still doesn't make sense, Groz. There's no excuse for the for what he said, but just trying to parse it a little bit for everybody out there and why it's an exciting thing and why it might be difficult to kind of explain why Shane Waldron offense might not be super complex, but it's complex at the same time.
It's not complex to be complex.
That's right.
All right, well, the pass rushing room for the Seahawks is a little crowded, so there's going to be some moving pieces. That's a good problem to have. So is second-round pick from 2020 Darrell Taylor the next strong side linebacker for the Seahawks this season, Jake?
Well, the first thing that jumps to mind is, wait a second, hold up. You drafted this guy to be your Leo, your pass-rushing defensive end. That's what the Seahawks call that position. They call it the Leo. That's very unique to the Seahawks, by the way. Not every pass-rushing defensive end across the league is called the Leo. So just so you know. But he talked about the transformation of going from that to potentially playing Sam linebacker. And here's Pete Carroll talking about and describing why Darrell Taylor could make potentially a seamless transition to that strong side linebacker position.
Well, he did a lot in college. You know, he did a lot of dropping, did a lot of rushing, and we liked him as a rusher first, which we still do. But he's got all of the athleticism. He's a real natural athlete, really light on his feet, burst, explosion. COD is really good. This is not going to be a challenge for him to learn the position. We need to see how he feels when we do mix him dropping and rushing, and then we'll knowing that we want to see him as an outside rusher as well in passing situations. So we're double teaching him, and you know, he's such a good looking athlete. He looks like he can do whatever you need him to do. So we have no really restrictions or hesitation on that.
So to put everybody at ease, you're not taking Darrell Taylor, who's been a defensive end his whole career, and then transitioning to a position that he's never played before. You know, you're stretching him. You're putting him in a unique position. Darrell Taylor has been an outside linebacker in a 3-4 scheme during his time at Tennessee, so he's familiar with having to drop back in coverage. He's familiar with having to play the edge in the run game and also being a pass rusher. So this is something that is comfortable to him. It's how quickly can you transition him to fit into your defensive scheme. And I think Darrell Taylor, this might be a perfect setup and a perfect way to get him on the field, as Brady Henderson from ESPN was on with us earlier. A very similar transition, a very similar way to get him on the field as it was for Bruce Irvin, when there was so much depth that you had at the defensive end position on both sides of the ball. Here's another way that you can add a great edge player and get him on the field. And so I think that's very much the way that the Seahawks are looking at this. And guys, I would even say that Darrell Taylor is the front runner to be your strong side linebacker this season. All right. We've got a Mariner. We've got, Groz, we've got a Mariner with a comment so aggressive, it might actually make you uncomfortable. Find out who it was coming up next on the timeline.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
Welcome to The Timeline. This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by The Pro Club. We're taking you through the biggest stories of the day. And Gross, I told you that a Mariner made a comment so aggressive, it might actually make you uncomfortable. Who is that? Well, it's J.P. Crawford talking about his mentality at the plate, and especially when it comes to top-level pitching talent like Shane Bieber.
People always make a big deal about who you're facing, you know, like, oh, you're facing Bieber, Kershaw, one of these pitchers. But at the same time, you guys can't go up there with the mindset of being, like, intimidated or anything like that. You have to be competitive and just say, hey, bring it on, right?
Absolutely. Bring it on. I'm going to rake your face. That's what I think up there at the box.
What?
I'm going to rake your face.
I'm going to rake your face. I mean, my goodness, that is aggressive right there.
That's a new one for me. Have you heard that one before?
I have never heard that one. And you know what it sounds like? It sounds like me when I mess up a phrase or a saying. I do it all the time. Everybody, the texters, they all make fun of me for doing it. I do it almost daily. And that's where it just doesn't sound quite right, right? Like, I'm going to rake your face. I mean, that's some strong words from J.P. Crawford, but I love the confidence.
Strong but puzzling words.
It is strong but puzzling. Now here, I think when we talk about the spark of Jared Kelnick, J.P. Crawford is a pretty, you know, for those who don't know, he's a pretty mild-mannered guy. I mean, he is, I would envision somebody in the clubhouse that everybody loves, that really likes, and very conversational and a breath of fresh air in terms of her personality. But to the public, he is very mild-mannered. He's low-key, plays the game with passion, but very, very strong to hear J.P. Crawford kind of talk like this, you know, not just the phrasing of it, but just the confidence level that he's exuding. And it sounds very much like Jared Kelnick here in cut number 4.
I mean, I'm a competitor. I want to win. I want to bury our opponents each and every night. And it truly bugs me when I give away at-bats or if I don't execute on what I'm trying to do.
Now, Graz, look, talk is cheap, right? It's all about performance. Right. But there is definitely a different attitude that's going on within that clubhouse.
Agreed. And it's one that can lead to success if you can maintain it. If you can keep it going throughout a long season, it can definitely lead to success.
Yeah, it definitely can, and that's what I'm going to be very much keeping an eye on, and I think that confidence, that swagger that you have, it can rub off on other people around you, and I think that when you talk like that, you approach the game like that. To me, it's a big change from what you've had here in the clubhouse with the Mariners. It's a positive change in my mind as you look forward to one of the things that we've always talked about. Is how is Scott Service, how is this organization during the rebuilding process, you tear it down to the studs and you're going to lose games, how do you come out on the other side and have built a winner, have built a winning mindset? Well, it's making sure that you have the right personalities to go along with it, and I love hearing stuff like that out of these guys, very positive to me. Graz, some other big things that happened over the weekend in the 2020 Basketball Hall of Fame class was inducted over the weekend, including all-time greats such as Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, and Kevin Garnett. Now, Graz, what player stands out to you out of those three players? What career do you think stands out to you? Well, we're having some technical difficulties there with the Graz, but you look at some of these names, such as Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett. They all brought their unique, play to the table. With Kobe Bryant being, in my opinion, the closest thing to Michael Jordan since we've seen Michael Jordan in terms of his overall skill set and his tenacity, the way that he approached the game. Tim Duncan being the ultimate Mr. Fundamental. And Kevin Garnett, just, you know, the passion that he brought at the power forward position. You know, Graz, before we lost you there, I was asking you, Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, which one of those careers, you got to watch all those guys very closely as you covered the Sonics, which one of those three stood out to you the most, and what do you treasure about all three of those guys' games?
I love the big fundamental because of who he was, and there were so few players that played in his era with the back to the basket and played as effective as he did. He was terrific, and the San Antonio teams were always underrated because the Lakers were always so much flashier, and that's because of Kobe Bryant to a great extent, and the titles that he won with and without Shaq, and won some without Shaq, and you think of a guy, how many guys in their last game have a final game like Kobe had? What did he score, 60-something in that game?
Yes.
Or was it 60 even? Yeah, it was just absolutely incredible. Garnett didn't have as many career highlights, but was also a great basketball player. I mean, those are three great ones. I would say of the careers, the one that probably stood out the most was Kobe.
Yeah, I would too. And you talk about his legacy, not just because of his passing, but what he would have left even if he was still here with us, and we all wish he was. But, you know, that Mamba mentality that so many of these, you hear the younger generation across every sport talk about Kobe, yeah. His Mamba mentality, much like Jordan, and the impact that he had on the generation that came after him. So absolutely some all-time greats. And want to fit this one in here real quick. Legendary broadcaster Marv Albert says he'll retire at the conclusion of the Eastern Conference Finals of the NBA playoffs. Graz, a definite legend to the sport.
Well, Marv is a legendary broadcaster and a legendary guy. If you recall, he got into some trouble about a decade ago that would have sunk most broadcasters, and they would have been able to come back from it. And because he is such a nice guy, and I had a quick story with him, was when the Dream Team was first put together, the first Dream Team, the real Dream Team, and they were playing an exhibition game in Portland, and I went down with my former partner, and we were doing our show from way up in the stands. You know, the game was taking place later on that night, and Marv Albert came walking by. You know, we saw him walking down on the floor, and we sent our producer just for a laugh to see if we could you know, get him to come up or at least point and laugh and see. You know, we were way up in the cheap seats. And he asked Marv, and Marv turned around and walked up and did the interview with us. He just never said no, always said yes, always did a nice – it was a terrific interview too, always said nice things. So, you know, his career was able to overcome some hurdles, and I think one of the best ever to do basketball. It was certainly Marv, and it'll be bittersweet when he retires at the end of the Eastern Conference Finals for sure.
There's no doubt about that. All right, the past has taught us one thing, Graz, a very, very important life lesson when it comes to star talents like Jared Kelnick. Find out what that is next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Welcome back to Jake and Stacey. I am Jake Heaps, filling in as the lead host for Stacey, who is out. And we've got the legendary Graz joining us here today. Graz, we talked about one very important life lesson when it comes to star talents like Jared Kelnick. And that important life lesson is patience. Patience is key when it comes to star talents like Jared Kelnick. And the reason why patience is key is because you need to let these guys play out. You need to let them develop and not make snapshot judgments based off of their first series here at the big league level, their first 40 games, their first 100 games. And we've got plenty of examples lined up ready to illustrate the fact that this is going to be an ongoing process for someone like Jared Kelnick. Does it mean that this kid, you know, shouldn't have high expectations put upon him? Does it mean that he might not perform at be the AL Rookie of the Year this year? He very well could be. But not to panic, to have patience through the process as we're watching somebody like him, Graz.
Agreed. Agree 1,000%. And it will take it's a matter of months, and it's a matter of a couple of years before you really make the determination as to where he's at. And you hope that he's excited about what's going on. And look, guys can spike and have great first years in baseball, and then can struggle after that. I mean, the Mariners have seen that here with I think Dustin Ackley comes to mind, who was the second player taken overall, had a really nice looking rookie year, looked like he was going to turn into a hell of a player, and just didn't happen. So it's very difficult. You want to get excited, but to try and temper it with the knowledge that it's just three games. But this is a guy that a lot of people thought was a was a top prospect, would be a top-flight major league player. I don't think his debut, his first series, anything to change that. Though I did point out at the start of the show, remember, he's 3-for-18. He struck out 5 times in the series. You know, he had a great game where he had the 3 hits on Friday. Those were the only games he had any hits in. So it's still a learning process for him. But it's exciting to watch at the same time, too. There's no reason not to be excited with what you're seeing. It's a while before you can determine whether or not it's for real.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to give you guys 3 examples as to what we're talking about and why we're saying patience is the key. I mean, you look at Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who in his third season, he is really finding his footing in the league and performing at a true all-star level that everybody knew that his talent could produce. He was the consensus number one prospect in baseball, being called up at age 20. He, along the way, was making an impact his rookie season, his second season in the league, and now his third year he's taken off. 2019, you know, 15 home runs, 69 RBIs, he hits 270. You know, you got 2020, dips down, goes 262, 9 home runs, 33 RBIs in a, you know, COVID year. And now in 2021, he's hitting over 300, and he's towards the top of the bigs in terms of home runs and RBIs. So, you know, he's a great, you know, recent example as somebody that can continue to go through the learning process, played well his first year, but now really taking off in his third year. Mike Trout, how about his first year? 40 games, he hit 220, Gross. He was hitting 220 in his first 40 games, first 135 plate appearances. The following year, takes off and is the Mike Trout that we all know, one of the best players in baseball. Alex Rodriguez, you know, bring it back to 1994, Gross, in the heyday of the Gross father. You know, A-Rod just hitting a tick over 200 in 47 games in 1995. So, and then, you know, 47 games in 1995, he's hitting, you know, just 232. So, you know, it's not always an indicator of what this player is going to be. And again, I'm not saying temper your expectations out there. I'm just saying that Jared Kelnick, you need to let him find his footing. Let him find his way. And this kid's a talent. He is an absolute talent that I think is going to continue to keep making positive strides and is going to continue to find ways to impact this club.
It's very rare to have a player's best year, a great player's best year, to be his first year. I mean, we saw it here with Ichiro, and I can't think of another guy who was that in that category, who would go on and have a career almost as good as his first year. And his first year was the best year of his career. It was MVP and Rookie of the Year and was just absolutely outstanding and was a veteran player coming in anyway. I think that the difference maybe with Kelnick is he didn't have a lot of minor league at-bats. That's going to hurt him a little bit. But he's of an age now, you know, in his early 20s, where he's ready to play Major League Baseball. So I think just sit back and enjoy the ride is kind of the thing, and don't get too bogged down by the downs. As you pointed out, it's a process for guys to learn, and most guys struggle in their first year, but they show you signs of what they can be. And I think even in this little 3-game, 4-game series, we saw what Kelenic can be. I mean, we saw what he has to offer, what he can be when he's a fully functioning, quote unquote, major leaguer and used to everything. So it's an exciting time as well.
Gross, I want to ask you the question of, do you think that in baseball that we'll ever get to a point where the learning curve is accelerated for these young players versus the past? Like, for example, in football, we've seen quarterbacks be able to, more and more, they've been able to start as true freshmen in college. They're more likely to, not always, but they're more likely to hit the ground running when they get to the NFL level than they ever have. Do you see that potentially happening in baseball? Have we seen that happen in recent years? Or is baseball one of those unique sports where it's always going to be an incredible jump from the minors to the bigs?
It's always going to be a jump, but you know, we've seen Juan Soto, for example, with the Nationals, play at 19. We've seen guys play at a very young age with very little minor league experience. But for the most part, there's no denying that you need the experience in the minor leagues to just be able to tackle what you see in the major leagues. That it's changing a little bit. You're seeing guys that take fewer at bats to get there, but I don't, and there have always been examples of guys who have not played in the minors at all, very, very few and far between. But you really have not seen that change as much as you've seen other things change in sports, where in baseball you still talk about guys needing the number 800 to 1,000 at-bats in the minor leagues, kind of get ready to play major league ball, and that's still kind of the case. So that hasn't changed a whole lot.
You know, Graz, I think that that's going to be one of the unique aspects of baseball, that, you know, it is so incredibly hard. I mean, hitting 300, 3 out of 10 is considered extremely good at baseball, mm-hmm. and it's always going to be a big jump when you see, you know, the way pitching has just absolutely taken off for some of these young hitters. This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by the Pro Club. Now, coming up next, the Bears continue to find ways to keep being adamant that Andy Dalton is the guy for this upcoming year. But first, we're going to talk to Jason Churchill of ProspectInsider.com and host of the Baseball Things podcast, All Things Mariners, coming up next.